Lancre is cut off from the rest of the lands of mankind by a bridge over Lancre Gorge, above the shallow but poisonously fast and treacherous Lancre River. The Lancrastrians did not consider geography to be a very original science. The coach pulled up at the far end. There was a badly painted red, black and white post across the road. The coachman sounded his horn.
What's up? Said Ridcully, leaning out of the window.
Troll bridge.
Oops.
After a while, there was a booming sound under the bridge, and a troll clambered over the parapet. It was quite overdressed for a troll. In addition to the statutory loincloth, it was wearing a helmet. Admittedly, it had been designed for a human head and was attached to the much larger troll head by string, but there probably wasn't a better word than wearing.
What's up? Said the bursar, waking up. There's a troll on the bridge, said Ridcully, but it's underneath a helmet, so it's probably official and will get into serious trouble if it eats people. Nothing to worry about.
Trolls, a life form based on silicon rather than carbon, can't in fact digest people, but there's always someone ready to give it a try. The bursar giggled because he was on the up curve of whatever switchback his mind was currently riding. The troll appeared at the coach window.
"Afternoon, your lordships," it said. "Customs inspection."
"I don't think we have any," babbled the bursar happily. "I mean, we used to have a tradition of rolling boiled eggs downhill on Soul Cake Tuesday, but..."
"I means," said the troll, "do you have any beer, spirits, wines, liquors, hallucinogenic herbage, or books of a lewd or licentious nature?"
Ridcully pulled the bursar back from the window.
"No," he said.
"No."
"No."
"Sure."
"Yes."
"Would you like some?"
"We haven't even got," said the bursar, despite Ridcully's efforts to sit on his head, "any billy goats."
There are some people that would whistle Yankee Doodle in a crowded bar in Atlanta. Even these people would consider it tactless to mention the word billy goat to a troll. The troll's expression changed very slowly, like a glacier eroding half a mountain. Ponder tried to get under the seat.
"So we'll just trit trot along, shall we?" said the bursar, his voice by now slightly muffled.
He doesn't mean it," said the Arch-Chancellor quickly. It's the dried frog talking."
"You don't want to eat me," said the bursar. "You want to eat my brother. He's..."
"Well, no," said the troll. "Seems to me that..."
He spotted Casanunda.
"Oh-ho," he said. "Dwarf smuggling, eh?"
"Oh, don't be ridiculous, man," said Ridcully. "There's no such thing as dwarf smuggling."
"Oh, yeah? Then what's that you've got there?"
"I'm a giant," said Casanunda. "Giants are a lot bigger. I've been ill."
The troll looked perplexed. This was postgraduate thinking for a troll, but he was looking for trouble. He found it on the roof of the coach, where the librarian had been sunbathing.
"What's in the sack up there?"
That's not a sack, that's the librarian."
The troll prodded the large mass of red hair.
"Ooh! What a monkey! Ooh!"
Several minutes later, the travellers leaned on the parapet, looking down reflectively at the river far below.
"Happen often, does it?"
said Casanunda.
"Not so much these days," said Ridcully. "It's like, what's that word, Stibbons? About breeding and passing on stuff to your kids?"
"Evolution," said Ponder.
The ripples were still sloshing against the banks.
Right. Like, my father had a waistcoat with embroidered peacocks on it, and he left it to me, and now I've got it. They call it hereditary.
No, that's not..."
Ponder began, with no hope whatsoever that Ridcully would listen.
"So, anyway, most people left back home know the difference between apes and monkeys now," said Ridcully. "Evolution, that is. It's hard to breed when you've got a headache from being bounced up and down on the pavement."
The ripples had stopped now.
"Do you think trolls can swim?" said Casanunda.
"No, they just sink and walk ashore," said Ridcully.
He turned and leaned back on his elbows.
"This really takes me back, you know. The old Lancre River." There's trout down there that'd take your arm off.
Not just trout, said Ponder, watching a helmet emerge from the water.
And limpid pools further up, said Ridcully, full of limpids, stuff like that. And you can bathe naked and no one at sea. And water meadows full of water, don't you know? And flowers and stuff, he sighed. You know, it was on this very bridge that she told me that she...
He's got out of the river, said Ponder.
But the troll wasn't moving very fast, because the librarian was nonchalantly levering one of the big stones out of the parapet.
On this very bridge, I asked...
That's a big club he's got, said Casanunda.
This bridge, I may say, was where I nearly...
Could you stop holding that rock in such a provocative way?
Said Ponder.
Ooh!
It'd be a help.
The actual bridge, if anyone's interested, is where my whole life took a different...
Why don't we just go on? Said Ponder. He's got a steep climb. Good thing for him he hasn't got up here, eh?
Said Casanunda. Ponder swiveled the librarian around and pushed him towards the coach.
This is the bridge, in fact, where...
Ridcully turned round.
Are you coming or not?
Said Casanunda with the reins in his hand.
I was actually having a quality moment of misty nostalgic remembrance, said Ridcully. Not that any of you buggers noticed, of course.
Ponder held the door open.
Well, you know what they say. You can't cross the same river twice, Arch-Chancellor, he said.
Ridcully stared at him.
Why not? This is a bridge.
On the roof of the coach, the librarian picked up the coach horn, bit the end of it reflectively, well, you never knew, and then blew it so hard that it uncurled. It was early morning in Lancre town, and it was more or less deserted. Farmers had got up hours before to curse and swear and throw a bucket at the cows, and had then gone back to bed. The sound of the horn bounced off the houses. Ridcully leapt out of the coach and took a deep, theatrical breath.
"Can't you smell that?" he said. "That's real fresh mountain air, that is."
He thumped his chest.
"I've just trodden in something rural," said Ponder. "Where is the castle, sir?"
"I think it could be that huge black towering thing looming over the town,"
said Casanunda. The Arch-Chancellor stood in the middle of the square and turned slowly with his arms spread wide.
"See that tavern?" he said.
"Ha! If I had a penny for every time they threw me out of there, I'd have $5.38. And over there is the old forge, and there's Mrs. Persifleur's, where I had lodgings. See that peak up there? That's Copperhead, that is. I climbed that one day with old Carbonaceous the Troll. Oh, great days, great days. And see that wood down there on the hill? That's where she..."
His voice trailed into a mumble.
"Oh, my word. It all comes back to me. What a summer that was. They don't make them like that anymore," he sighed. "You know," he said, "I'd give anything to walk through those woods with her again. There were so many things we never..."
"Oh, well. Come on." Ponder looked around at Lancre. He'd been born and raised in Ankh-Morpork. As far as he was concerned, the countryside was something that happened to other people, and most of them had four legs. As far as he was concerned, the countryside was like raw chaos before the universe, which was to say something with cobbles and walls, something civilized, was created.
"This is the capital city," he said.
"More or less,"
said Casanunda, who tended to feel the same way about places that weren't paved.
"I bet there's not a single delicatessen anywhere," said Ponder.
"And the beer here," said Ridcully, "the beer here, well, you just better taste the beer here. And there's stuff called scumble. They make it from apples, and damned if I know what else they put in it, except you daren't pour it into metal mugs. You ought to try it, Mr. Stibbons. It'd put hair on your chest. And yours."
He turned to the next one down from the coach, who turned out to be the librarian.
"Book? Well, I should just drink anything you like in your case," said Ridcully.
He hauled the mail sack down from the roof.
"What do we do with this?" he said.
There were ambling footsteps behind him, and he turned to see a short, red-faced youth in ill-fitting and baggy chainmail, which made him look like a lizard that had lost a lot of weight very quickly.
"Where's the coach driver?"
said Shornog. "'He's ill,' said Ridcully. "'He had a sudden attack of bandits. "'What do we do with the mail?'
"'I take the palace stuff, and we generally leave the sack hanging up on a nail outside the tavern so that people can help themselves,' said Sean. "'Isn't that dangerous?' said Ponder. "'Don't think so. It's a strong nail,' said Sean, rummaging in the sack. "'I mean, don't people steal letters?' "'Oh, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that. "'One of the witches go and stare at them if they did that.'
Sean stuffed a few packages under his arm and hung the sack on the aforesaid nail.
"'Yes, that's another thing they used to have round here,' said Ridcully. "'Witches. Let me tell you about the witches round here.'
"'Our mum's a witch,'
said Sean, conversationally, rummaging in the sack. "'As fine a body of women as you could hope to meet,' said Ridcully, with barely a hint of mental gear clashing. "'And not a bunch of interfering power-mad old crones at all, whatever anyone might say.'
"'Are you here for the wedding?'
"'That's right. I'm the Arch-Chancellor of Unseen University. This is Mr. Stibbons, a wizard. Where are you? Oh, there you are. This is Mr. Kasananda.'
"'Count,' said Kasananda. "'I'm a count.'
"'Really? You never said?'
"'Well, you don't, do you? It's not the first thing you say.'
Ridcully's eyes narrowed. "'But I thought dwarfs didn't have titles,' he said.
"'I performed a small service for Queen Agantia of Skund,' said Kasananda.
"'Did you? My word. How small?'
"'Not that small.'
"'My word. And that's the bursar, and this is the librarian.'
Ridcully took a step backwards, waved his hands in the air, and silently mouthed the words, "'Don't say monkey.'
"'Pleased to meet you,' said Sean politely.
Ridcully felt moved to investigate. "'The librarian,' he repeated.
"'Yes, you said,'
Sean nodded at the orangutan.
"'How'd you do?'
"'Ook!'
"'You might be wondering why he looks like that,' Ridcully prompted.
"'No, sir.'
"'No?
My mum says none of us can help how we're made,' said Sean.
"'What a singular lady, and what is her name?' said Ridcully.
"'Mrs. Ogg, sir.'
"'Ogg? Ogg?' "'Name rings a bell. Any relation to sobriety, Og?'
"'He was my dad, sir.'
"'Good grief. Old sobriety's son. How is the old devil?
"'Do you know, sir, what with him being dead?'
"'Oh, dear. How long ago?'
"'These past 30 years,' said Sean. "'But you don't look any older than 20,'
Ponder began. Ridcully elbowed him sharply in the ribcage.
"'This is the countryside,' he hissed. "'People do things differently here.' "'And more often.'
"'He turned back to Sean's pink and helpful face.
"'Things seem to be waking up a bit,' he said, "'and indeed shutters were coming down around the square. "'We'll get some breakfast in the tavern. "'They used to do wonderful breakfasts.'
"'He sniffed again and beamed. "'Now that,' he said, "'is what I call fresh air.' "'Sean looked around carefully.
"'Yes, sir,' he said. "'That's what we call it, too.'
There was the sound of someone frantically running, and then a pause, and King Verence II appeared around the corner, walking slowly and calmly with a very red face.
"'Certainly gives people a rosy complexion,'
said Ridcully cheerfully.
"'It's the king,' hissed Sean, "'and me without me trumpet.'
Said Verence. "'Post been yet, Sean?'
"'Oh, yes, sire,'
said Sean, almost as flustered as the king.
"'Got it right here. Don't you worry about it. I'll open it all up and have it on your desk right away, sire.'
"'Something
the matter, sire?'
"'I think perhaps—'
Sean was already tearing at the wrappers.
"'Here's that book on etiquette you've been waiting for, sire, and the pig stock book, and—'
"'Ooh,
what's this one?'
Verence made a grab for it. Sean automatically tried to hang on to it. The wrapping split, and the large, bulky book thumped onto the cobbles. Its fluttering pages played their woodcuts to the breeze. They looked down.
"'Wow!'
said Sean.
"'My word,' said Ridcully.
Said the king.
"'Ook!'
Sean picked up the book very, very carefully and turned a few pages.
"'Hey! Look at this one! He's doing it with his feet! I didn't know you could do it with your feet!'
He nudged Ponder Stibbons.
"'Look, sir!'
Ridcully peered at the king. "'You all right, Your Majesty?' he said. Verence squirmed.
"'And look, here's one with both chaps are doing it with sticks.'
"'What?'
said Verence.
"'Wow!' said Sean. "'Thank you, sire. This is going to really come in handy, I can tell you. I mean, I've picked up bits and pieces here and there, but—'
Verence snatched the book from Sean's hands and looked at the title page.
Martial arts. Martial arts? But I'm sure I wrote marital...
Sire?
There was one exquisite moment while Verence fought for mental balance, but he won.
Ah, yes, right. Yes, of course. Well, you see, a well-trained army is essential to the security of any kingdom. That's right. Yes, fine. Magrat and me, we thought,
Yes, it's for you, Sean.
I'll start practicing right away, sire.
Good.
Jason Ogg awoke and wished he hadn't. Let's be clear, many authorities have tried to describe a hangover. Dancing elephants and so on are often employed for this purpose. The descriptions never work. They always smack of, ho-ho, here's one for the lads, let's have some hangover machismo, ho-ho, landlord, another 19 pints of lager, hey, we supped some stuff last night, ho-ho. Anyway, you can't describe a scumble hangover. The best bit of it is a feeling that your teeth have dissolved and coated themselves on your tongue. Eventually, the blacksmith sat up and opened his eyes. Insert the usual red-hot curried marbles description here, if you like. His clothes were soaked with dew. His head felt full of wisps and whispers. He stared at the stones. The scumble jar was lying in the heather. After a moment or two, he picked it up and took an experimental swig. It was empty. He nudged Weaver in the ribs with his boot.
"Wake up, you old bugger. We've been here all night."
One by one, the Morris men made the short but painful journey into consciousness.
"I'm going to get some stick from Air Eva when I get home," moaned Carter.
"You might not," said Thatcher, who was on his hands and knees looking for his hat. "Maybe when you gets home she'll have married someone else, eh?"
"Maybe 100 years will have gone past," said Carter, hopefully.
"Cool, I hope so," said Weaver, brightening up. "I had sevenpence invested in the thrift bank down in Ahulan. I'll be a millionaire at complicated interest. I'll be as rich as creosote."
"Who's creosote?" said Thatcher. "Famous rich bugger," said Baker, fishing one of his boots out of a peat pool. "Foreign."
"Wasn't he the one everything he touched turned to gold?" said Carter.
"Nah, that was someone else. Some king or other. That's what happens in foreign parts. One minute you're all right, the next minute everything you touch turns to gold. He was plagued with it."
Carter looked puzzled.
"How did he manage when he had to..." "Let that be a lesson to you, young Carter," said Baker. "You stay here where folks are sensible, not go gadding off abroad where you might suddenly be holding a fortune in your hands and not have anything to spend it on."
"We've slept out here all night," said Jason uncertainly. "That's dangerous, that is."
"You're right there, Mr. Ogg," said Carter. "I think something went to the toilet in my ear."
"I mean, strange things can enter your head."
"That's what I mean, too."
Jason blinked. He was certain he dreamed. He could remember dreaming, but he couldn't remember what the dream had been about. But there was still the feeling in his head of voices talking to him, but too far away to be heard.
"Oh, well," he said,
managing to stand up at a third attempt.
"Probably no harm done. Let's get on home and see what century it is."
"What century is it, anyway?" said Thatcher. "Century of the fruit bat, isn't it?" said Baker.
"Might not be any more," said Carter, hopefully.
It turned out that it was indeed the century of the fruit bat. Lancre didn't have much use for units of time any smaller than an hour or larger than a year, but people were clearly putting up bunting in the town square, and a gang of men were erecting the maypole. Someone was nailing up a very badly painted picture of Verence and Magrat, under which was the slogan, "Gods bless their majesties." With hardly a word exchanged, the men parted and staggered their separate ways. A hare lolloped through the morning mists until it reached the drunken ancient cottage in its clearing in the woods. It reached a tree stump between the privy and the herbs. Most woodland animals avoided the herbs. This was because animals that didn't avoid the herbs over the last 50 years had tended not to have descendants. A few tendrils waved in the breeze, and this was odd because there wasn't any breeze. It sat on the stump. And then there was a sensation of movement. Something left the hare and moved across the air to an open upstairs window. It was invisible, at least to normal eyesight. The hare changed. Before, it had moved with purpose. Now it flopped down and began to wash its ears. After a while, the back door opened and Granny Weatherwax walked out stiffly, holding a bowl of bread and milk. She put it down on the step and turned back without a second glance, closing the door again behind her. The hare hopped closer. It's hard to know if animals understand obligations or the nature of transactions, but that doesn't matter. They're built into witchcraft. If you want to really upset a witch, do her a favour which she has no means of repaying. The unfulfilled obligation will nag at her like a hangnail. Granny Weatherwax had been riding the hare's mind all night. Now she owed it something. There'd be bread and milk left outside for a few days. You had to repay, good or bad. There was more than one type of obligation. That's what people never really understood, she told herself as she stepped back into the kitchen. Magrat hadn't understood it, nor that new girl. Things had to balance. You couldn't set out to be a good witch or a bad witch. It never worked for long. All you could try to be was a witch, as hard as you could. She sat down by the cold hearth and resisted a temptation to comb her ears. They had broken in somewhere. She could feel it in the trees, in the minds of tiny animals. She was planning something. Something soon. There was, of course, nothing special about midsummer in the occult sense, but there was in the minds of people. And the minds of people was where elves were strong. Granny knew that sooner or later she'd have to face the Queen. Not Magrat, but the real Queen. And she would lose. She'd worked all her life on controlling the insides of her own head. She'd prided herself on being the best there was. But no longer. Just when she needed all her self-reliance, she couldn't rely on her mind. She could sense the probing of the Queen. She could remember the feel of that mind from all those decades ago. And she seemed to have her usual skill at borrowing. But herself. If she didn't leave little notes for herself, she'd be totally at sea. Being a witch meant knowing exactly who you were and where you were, and she was losing the ability to know both. Last night she'd found herself setting the table for two people. She'd tried to walk into a room she didn't have. And soon she'd have to fight an elf. If you fought an elf and lost, then, if you were lucky, you would die. Magrat was brought breakfast in bed by a giggling Millie Chillum.
"Guests are arriving already, ma'am, and there's flags and everything down in the square, and Sean has found the coronation coach."
"How can you lose a coach?" said Magrat.
"It was locked up in one of the old stables, ma'am. He's giving it a fresh coat of gold paint right now."
"But we're going to be married here," said Magrat. "We don't have to go anywhere."
"The King said perhaps you could both ride around a bit, maybe as far as Badass," he said, "with Sean Ogg as a military escort, so people could wave and shout hooray and then come back here."
Magrat put on her dressing gown and crossed to the tower window. She could see down over the outer walls and into Lancre Town Square, which was already quite full of people. It would have been a market day in any case, but people were erecting benches as well, and the maypole was already up. There were even a few dwarfs and trolls, politely maintaining a distance from one another.
"I just saw a monkey walk across the square," said Magrat.
"The whole world's coming to Lancre," said Millie, who had once been as far as Slice.
Magrat caught sight of the distant picture of herself and her fiancé.
"This is stupid,"
she said to herself, but Millie heard her and was shocked.
"What can you mean, ma'am?"
Magrat spun round.
"All this for me."
Millie backed away in sudden fright.
"I'm just Magrat Garlic. Kings ought to marry princesses and duchesses and people like that. People who are used to it. I don't want people shouting hooray just because I've gone by in a coach. And especially not people who've known me all my life. All this...
Her frantic gesture took in the hated garde-robe, the huge four-poster bed, and the dressing room full of stiff and expensive clothes.
"This stuff, it's not for me. It's for some kind of idea. Didn't you ever get those cutouts, those dolls, you know, when you were a girl? Dolls you cut out. And there were cut-out clothes as well. And you could make her anything you wanted. That's me. It's like the bees. I'm being turned into a queen whether I want it or not. That's what's happening to me."
"I'm sure the king bought you all those nice clothes, because I don't just mean the clothes. I mean, people would be shouting hooray if anyone went past in the coach." "But you were the one who fell in love with the king, ma'am,"
said Millie, bravely. Magrat hesitated for a moment. She'd never quite analysed that emotion. Eventually she said,
"No, he wasn't a king then. No one knew he was going to be a king. He was just a sad, nice little man in a cap and bells who everyone ignored."
Millie backed away a bit more.
"I expect it's nerves, ma'am," she gabbled. "Everyone feels nervous on the day before their wedding. Shall I see if I can make you some herbal?"
I'm not nervous, and I can do my own herbal tea if I happen to want any.
Cook's very particular who goes into the herb garden, ma'am, said Millie.
I've seen that herb garden. It's all leggy sage and yellowy parsley. If you can't stuff it up a chicken's bum, she doesn't think it's a herb. Anyway, who's queen in this vicinity?
I thought you didn't want to be, ma'am, said Millie.
Magrat stared at her. For a moment she looked as if she was arguing with herself. Millie might not have been the best informed girl in the world, but she wasn't stupid. She was at the door and threw it just as the breakfast tray hit the wall. Magrat sat down on the bed with her head in her hands. She didn't want to be queen. Being a queen was like being an actor, and Magrat had never been any good at acting. She'd always felt she wasn't very good at being Magrat if it came to that. The bustle of the pre-nuptial activities rose up from the town. There'd be folk dancing, of course. There seemed to be no way of preventing it. And probably folk singing would be perpetrated. And there'd be dancing bears and comic jugglers and the greasy pole competition, which for some reason Nanny Ogg always won, and bowling with a pig and the bran tub, which Nanny Ogg usually ran. It was a brave man who plunged his hand into a bran tub stocked by a witch with a broad sense of humour. Magrat had always liked the fairs, up until now. Well, there were still some things she could do. She dressed herself up in her commoner's clothes for the last time, and let herself out and down the back stairs to the Widdershins Tower and the room where Diamanda lay. Magrat had instructed Sean to keep a good fire going in the grate, and Diamanda was still sleeping peacefully, the unwakeable sleep. Magrat couldn't help noticing that Diamanda was strikingly good-looking, and from what she'd heard, quite brave enough to stand up to Granny Weatherwax. She could hardly wait to get her better so that she could envy her properly. The wound seemed to be healing up nicely, but there seemed to be... Magrat strode to the bell pull in the corner and hauled on it. After a minute or two, Sean Ogg arrived, panting. There was gold paint on his hands.
"What," said Magrat, "are all these things?"
"Don't like to say, ma'am."
"One happens to be very nearly the Queen," said Magrat.
"Yes, but the King said... Well, Granny said..."
"Granny Weatherwax does not happen to rule the kingdom," said Magrat. She hated herself when she spoke like this, but it seemed to work. "And anyway, she's not here. One is here, however, and if you don't tell One what's going on, I'll see to it that you do all the dirty jobs around the palace."
"But I do all the dirty jobs anyway," said Sean.
"I shall see to it that there are dirtier ones." Magrat picked up one of the bundles. It was made up of strips of sheet wrapped around what turned out to be an iron bar. "They're all around her," she said.
"Why?"
Sean looked at his feet. There was gold paint on his boots, too.
"Well, our mum said..."
"Yes?"
"Our mum said I was to see to it that there was iron around her. So me and Millie got some bars from down the smithy and wrapped them up like this, and Millie packed them round her."
"Why?"
"To keep away the lords and ladies, ma'am."
"What? That's just old superstition. Anyway, everyone knows elves were good, whatever Granny Weatherwax says."
Behind her, Sean flinched. Magrat pulled the wrapped iron lumps out of the bed and tossed them into the corner. "No old wives' tales here, thank you very much. Is there anything else people haven't been telling me, by any chance?" Sean shook his head, guiltily aware of the thing in the dungeon.
"Well, go away. Verence wants the kingdom to be modern and efficient, and that means no horseshoes and stuff around the place. Go on, go away."
"Yes, Miss Queen."
"At least I can do something positive around here," Magrat told herself.
"Yes. Be sensible. Go and see him. Talk."
Magrat clung to the idea that practically anything could be sorted out if only people talked to one another. "Sean?" He paused at the door.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Has the King gone down to the Great Hall yet?"
"I think he's still dressing, Miss Queen. He hasn't rung for me to do the trumpet, I know that."
In fact, Verence, who didn't like going everywhere preceded by Sean's idea of a fanfare, had already gone downstairs incognito. But Magrat slipped along to his room and knocked on the door. Why be bashful? It'd be her room as well from tomorrow, wouldn't it? She tried the handle. It turned. Without quite willing it, Magrat went in.